Hare Krishna. Thank you all for coming. Premananda, could you put on the slide projector and put on the first four of those truths? Because we were telling a story, but not an ordinary story. A story ordinary in the sense that it's true, but extraordinary in the sense that this person, Narada Muni, lived a life that was so exemplary that if we follow it and follow the truths that he spoke through his life and through his actions and words, then we will get the most incredible result. Before I begin, as in the first two classes, I made a sort of an announcement or a pronouncement that because I've been in the Hare Krishna tradition for 50 years, and naturally the concepts and vocabulary that we explain things in will be the language of the Hare Krishna tradition. But truth is truth. I found myself saying that truth is truth. So if you have a bit of a difference in concept or a difference in language, then you can feel free to translate it into the surrounding that allows you to take this medicine without spitting it out, so to speak. So, because truth is truth, and it may come in its different forms, but truth is truth. So, we told the story of Narada Muni, and prior to him being Narada Muni, he was a very blessed and beautiful person who sang so sweetly, and he was a bit proud of that. And because of his using his gift, and there is a real big message in this one, I find, that the gifts that we have, they're really gifts. And one shouldn't be proud of one's gifts, because in a moment, the gift can be taken away. And then we think it's us, we think it's ours, but when it's gone, it's gone. So no one should be proud of whatever gifts they have. And everyone has certain gifts. Everyone has gifts. Unique gifts. That is the meaning of us being individuals. We have unique gifts. So those gifts, that opulence that we've been gifted with, is meant to be offered back to the giver of the gifts. My teacher, Srila Prabhupada, he once told the story of how one father had several sons, and on one day of the week, he gave each of the sons and daughters some money, a little bit of money, spending money. So naturally, the children were so happy on that day. And what did they do? They bought candy, they bought this toy, they bought that toy. But there was one of the children who took that same money that the father had given him, and he bought something for the father and said, "Please, you take this." Now, what do you think the father's reaction is to this, or the mother for that matter? They don't say, "Yes, that's a silly child." The last thought that enters their mind is this one: "You're such a silly child. I've given you this with my money, and then you're just giving it. I can buy hundreds of them, silly child." No, 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 no. Rather, that parent's heart melts Where's the beeping coming from?
That's a good question.
Yeah. As a, okay, who's beeping? Admit it. Are you beeping? So, now the parent's heart melts because this child is not beeping. Excuse me, what is it?
I'm trying to turn it off.
Oh, it's, you're the beeper, the mysterious beeper. Why don't you, do you know how to do it? You could always like throw it in a bucket of water. That usually works.
That's what happened last week, that's why I got this one.
This one's waterproof. But it's not beep-proof that you've done it. If you could like beep with like cow sounds or something like that, or flute sounds, we'd like it. But I don't want any beeps. So rather the father's heart melts. Oh, you've done this for me. He melts with the affection of the gift. Because it's the gift offered back to the person who gave it to you. And not you, not that he's angry at the others, because he wants them to be happy. But when someone has that type of a mood, that generosity of spirit, that gratitude, then that person becomes worthy of still greater gifts. And I see there's such a tendency. I recognize it very clearly that that when a gift passes through your hand, there's always the tendency to want to take something, even if it's 2% or 3% or 1%. But the real you could say the person with a golden heart, with the person, another way to look at it is the most intelligent. The other person who can look at it, way to look at it is the one who has the most sincere, the most earnest. He just simply says, "Please take this. You are worthy of it." So Narada Muni made that mistake. This was before he was Narada Muni. He was Supabharana, a great singer. Gandharva it is called in Sanskrit. And he made the mistake, which is a common mistake, that we all make, of thinking oneself as the one who is meant to enjoy, who has the capacity to enjoy. But the problem is that the reality is we enjoy most when we give it back. That brings pleasure to the heart. There's such a difference between superficial pleasures and true satisfaction, comfort. And the society nowadays is very expert at improving the comforts of people, but not very expert in improving their happiness, their satisfaction. So this is the methodology of satisfaction. And Narada Muni misused his gift, and he was cursed, to lose his opulence. So the first truth was, yes, that Narada Muni was placed in a difficult situation. Everyone here, at some points in their life, are placed in difficult situations. Some more than others, some less than others. But no one can avoid difficulty. No one can avoid difficulty in this world. It is not possible. What do we do when we're in difficulty? We tend to look towards distractions because on one level, life is just, it's difficulty. And we try to work our way through it and distract ourselves from the pains of life. There's some people who, you know, they just spend their whole time watching television, surfing the internet. You see, if you've ever gone to an old person's home, what do? To the old people? They just sit them down in front of televisions, and the old people just go, and it distracts them. Someone was telling me recently about someone that they knew who was soon to die, and they died peacefully. This person said, as if anyone really dies peacefully. But this person died peacefully, and all she wanted was to have, she had a stack of books that she wanted to read, and that was it. She just distracted herself. Distracted herself from something that's not very pleasant to confront. So the point that we want to make, what we wanted to make from that first part of the story, was that Narada Muni, in his previous life, did something and caused him difficulty in this life, in his present life. And because the difficulty was caused one birth ago, or could have been, practically speaking, 10 births ago, or 100 births ago, or maybe even 1,000 births ago, it's so difficult to unentangle it or dissolve the difficulty. The difficulties that we face. So rather than trying to dissolve the difficulties just by distraction or one problem, one way of dealing with it or another, there are better ways, more intelligent ways to deal with these difficult circumstances. And what Narada Muni did, he took his next birth as an impoverished, unfortunate young boy who had no opulence, who didn't know who his father was. His mother was poor, and she was just serving in some like hotel for traveling wise people, something like that. And he being 5 years old, he naturally took care. He naturally, because everyone wants to speak of children, except nowadays, I never thought I'd be one saying nowadays. When I was young, we were all, but actually when I was young, we were all pretty, at least I was pretty selfish. But Narada Muni, it's not natural to be selfish. It's not satisfying. Rather, what's natural is to serve. So the young children, they love to serve. Naturally. Unless they become spoiled. They just love to serve. So Narada Muni loved to serve, and he was a very good boy, even though he was poor, even though he didn't know who his father was. And he served these very exalted brahmanas who passed through his hotel for 4 months during the, what it's called in Sanskrit, Chaturmasya, which means literally 4 months when it is raining, and it's not practical to travel, so they sit in one place. They were called the Bhakti Vedantis. They were wise, they were learned, they were realized, and they sat and they would discuss spiritual topics amongst themselves. They would discuss about Krishna. And they would feel such happiness in that. They had that taste. They had cultivated that taste. And they had, they wanted that and nothing else. And that same taste was transferred to the heart of this boy, because there's a saying in English that I always think is funny. If you lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. Did you ever hear that? Is that, that's famous? Is there a Spanish version of it? Or something? If you lie down with dog, you can say it in Chinese. Is there some?
No. We'll have a
similar. If you lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. If you, I think it's funny anyway. It works the other way too. Whoever you associate with, you gain those qualities. If you associate with good people, you gain good qualities. If you associate with horrible people, you gain horrible qualities. And if you associate with very saintly people, that saintly person's taste goes to your heart. What he has a taste for goes to your heart. So Narada Muni, the boy, 5-year-old boy, he got a taste for spiritual topics. And he served them, and they were so happy with him, this little boy, because he was simple and sincere and actually wanted to please. Nowadays, like it's like the opposite of the way the world works, and not nowadays as if it was different, as I said, when I was growing up. But it was really like that when I was growing up, that, you know, the children naturally thought of themselves as the center, and it's the parents' business is just to please them. And it's quite an unnatural situation, in fact. What's natural is naturally one wants to please those in a greater position than ourselves. So they gave him knowledge. We won't go through the 4 points of the that they specifically gave him, but they gave him knowledge about Krishna, about his the supreme absolute truths, that nothing is separate from him, that his presence before the creation, during the creation, after the creation, and that if you see something as if it is separate from the Supreme Lord, this is the definition of Maya, illusion, because it's not real. How could something just pop into existence like that? Did these just pop into existence? No, there's always something behind. There's always a cause, a creator, an intelligence behind everything. It's never just chance. What happens by chance is chaos, simply. So they gave him truth, and he not only he heard it, and he took it in very, very, very deeply. And he understood from what they were saying that the real goal of life is to develop love for the Supreme Absolute, for Krishna. And that allows one to see that absolute truth, to see Krishna everywhere. Without love, you cannot do it, practically speaking. You cannot intellectually say, from now on I'm going to be spiritually conscious at all times and all places. It's not an intellectual adjustment that has to be made. It's much deeper than that. It's an adjustment of the heart. It's an adjustment at the very core of our self-identity. It takes love developing, prema bhakti jahapati, avidya vinasyati, and all ignorance goes away by the strength of that love. So he learned to see through this. He learned to see through knowledge. And getting knowledge is one thing, and getting knowledge is important, but actually seeing through knowledge is more difficult. What to speak of the next truth that we're going to hear about is actually applying it to your life. It's so much easier to give lectures than when there's difficulty to actually act on the platform of knowledge. This is the real art. It takes a great struggle with the mind, because the mind wants to run in the opposite direction usually. So he got knowledge, and he wanted to view, and he was able to view his life and the difficulties that were soon going to hit him through the lens of that transcendental knowledge. I didn't tell you to go to 3 yet. I wasn't quite ready for it. Now, go backwards. Now you have to delete that from your mind, okay? Don't make believe that you didn't see it says take advantage of difficulties. Oh, no, we backed up too much. Yes. And then those great sages left this boy. And that he wanted to go with them, but he was just a boy and his mother was there. He was dependent on his mother. His mother was dependent on him. And then one day, as cruel fate, unfortunate fate, sometimes strikes, Narada Muni's mother got bitten by a snake. And in an instant, she was there one day, and she was gone the next. Now, who could ever wish any difficulty upon at least ourselves? Sometimes we wish it on others, but in subtle ways, we can't do that in a gross way. It's too impolite. But there's this... No, I don't want to tell another long story. But I will anyway. I think it's an old Sufi story or something, that this man, he found some bottle. And he kept it in his house. And he had the person living next to him, he didn't have a good relationship with him. Because this person, whatever he had, whatever that man had, this person had more. And when you don't like it, when your neighbor prospers, what is that called? Envy. What is it called? Yes, it's called envy. 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 Yes. So, and when you're... Envy is worse than jealousy. When you're jealous, you wish you had what someone else has. But when you're envious, you want harm for that person. So, one day he was looking at this bottle, and he started magically rubbing it, and suddenly, poof, this creature came out and said, "Whatever you want, I'll give you. But, there's always a but, whatever you get, your neighbor's going to get twice as much." He said, "I want 4 Rolls Royces and a Jaguar." Poof! 4 Rolls Royces and a Jaguar. And he was so happy. But then he looks next door, and his neighbor had 8 Rolls Royces and 2 Jaguars. I mean, not the growly, not that kind, but the smooth, cool kind, expensive kind. And he suddenly thought, "Oh, this is terrible. This is terrible." So he rubbed. Do you know the story? You know the story? Do you know the story? Oh, good. I don't really get into it. Then he said, "Okay, what do I really want?" He looked at his neighbor's house. He said, "I want this huge mansion that's 3 stories high with a swimming pool, an indoor swimming pool, a helicopter pad on top, and everything." And the creature seemed like, and there it was. And then he made the mistake of looking to his neighbor's house, and he said, "2 helicopter pods, 6 stories high." And he thought, "Oh, this is terrible. This is terrible." He was burning. You know, it says that one of our great teachers, Narottama Das Thakur, says that envy is like a spear in the heart. Just like a spear in the heart. So if you have a spear in your heart, you cannot be happy or satisfied. How can you be satisfied with a spear in the heart? So he was more miserable by his acquisitions. And he thought and thought and thought, "How am I going to..." "I got it," he said. Roughly. "What do you want?" "Take out one of my eyes." That's envy, right? Because it's his neighbor. Yeah. Rather take it. So you can't be happy with that kind of a mood. You can't be happy with that kind of a mood. So the stress sometimes hits us. Difficulties hit us. And ultimately, death, the ultimate difficulty is going to hit us. And how are we going to deal with these things? We should view everything through the lens of transcendental knowledge. We should gain transcendental knowledge and view things through that, and then our life through that. And then if difficulties occur, yes, we should use knowledge to take advantage, to deepen spiritual advancement. Put into action that which we know is spiritually true, deep transcendental knowledge. So Narada Muni, what could he do? His mother had gone, he's just a young boy. He decided to just follow the path of these great saintly persons, and he began wandering, seeing, living in Krishna's mercy, practically speaking. He began to see everything that occurred to him as Krishna's mercy, and he wandered, and he wandered in good places, he wandered in bad places, and some days he got good food, some days he got bad food, some days he got no food, and he just took shelter. He took shelter in every circumstance. He took shelter, seeing that way. And in that way, the difficulties became helpful to him because they convinced him that yes, that these are true, because it's by a practically applying spiritual knowledge to life. That's how our that deepens our faith. That's how we become very experienced. Life is meant to collect jewels of spiritual realizations. It's a quest for jewels. We have to, each of us, we have different style difficulties, we have different karma, we have different fates, we have different lives, but to face, see them through the lens of transcendental knowledge and applying, and regardless of what happens, to take shelter, no matter what the mind is saying, to take shelter of Krishna. This is really the art of spiritual life, to take shelter, to have a deep shelter. And when life gets really difficult, then we are tested on the depth of our shelter. It's a test. And we just have to, and as I said, it's easier to give classes on this than to when it's happening, but we have to hold on very tight. So the question is, what do we hold on to? And that comes up very soon. Then Narada Muni, one day he sat down in a very holy place, or in the forest that was very, very beautiful, underneath a banyan tree, a swata tree, and he began to meditate as he had learned from the sages. And not that he was meditating on just existence. He was meditating on existence, but he was meditating not on the movements, becoming conscious of his mind. He was in control of his mind, but he was meditating upon the Lord who was in his heart. And then suddenly, through his mind, after placing the Lord in his heart, suddenly the actual Lord appeared. Sanskrit, Shakshat Darshan. He had direct vision of the Lord, and he became ecstatic. It is like being in the presence of the sun. Makes one so warm, being in the presence of a rose garden or a jasmine garden, fills one with such fragrance. Being in the presence of the actual presence of transcendence of Krishna fills one with Krishna's ecstasy, in a sense. So he became ecstatic, so ecstatic that he lost touch with himself. He was still an individual, but he just became so absorbed in the thoughts of the Lord, he just was thinking about him. And then just as soon as that vision appeared in his heart, it disappeared. And it was gone. He jumped up because he had lost that which was most valuable for him. And he tried again by his mechanical process of yogic meditation to get it back, but no use. He couldn't do it because it was just by grace. By Krishna's causes, mercy, that it occurred. And then he heard a voice, Sanskrit, Akashvani, an unembodied, instructive voice that said, Namam drastam ivarati. You will not be able to see me even one more time in this life. Because you are not yet pure enough. You have some kashayam, some impurities. You are not mature. Ivapakwa kashayanam. The darshan, I regret to tell you, will not be able to see me again in this life. And Narada Muni, the voice continued and said a few more things, and then it stopped. And he just reverently bowed his head. He didn't think how unfortunate he was, because he only saw the Lord once and the Lord should have stayed or whatever. No, he just thought himself the most fortunate person in existence. And one of the main things that the Lord told him at that time was that the reason why I have done this, given you this experience, it's because I want you to hanker for this. Because by the process of hankering for the spiritual realm, because our lives are so full of hankering and lamenting. But when we learn how to hanker, intensely desire the highest spiritual things, then all the impurities, this is basically, I'm expanding a little bit, but this is basically what that voice said, is that by this process of hankering and desiring, then whatever impurities in your heart are there, they will be dissolved. They will go away, because love for me will supplant them, surpass them. So Narada Muni, being already a great soul, having heard from great souls, having put into practice what he had heard, and then practicing them, and then getting some special grace, and then wanting that, like he never wanted anything before. He just continued his life, he continued his fate, and he just chanted and chanted and chanted and chanted and chanted. He took shelter continuously, and by that continuous taking shelter, by that continuous remembrance, by that continuous desiring, that places us in the association. That places us in the association of the absolute truth, and that association is what purifies us. We have a shelter. And everyone in this world needs a shelter. We are shelterless. And that's the part that's actually lacking, and we take shelter of things that don't have the capacity to actually give us shelter. So Narada Muni went through his life, and then one day always take shelter, always, in good times and bad, always take shelter. And what happened to Narada Muni while he was doing this is that his his impurities in his heart, which were very slight, contrasted to the impurities in my heart. They were dissolved. And on the other hand, by that constant association, by constantly being with the Supreme Absolute Truth, by constantly being with Krishna, then relationship developed and love developed. So when it came time for him to leave this world, immediately his spiritual identity, because he was cultivating it always inside by his desiring, immediately it manifested. As soon as his material body dropped, he was already in the spiritual realm because he had been cultivating that so fully. Now, this is such a wonderful story, we will call it a pastime even of a great soul. It's such a wonderful story, but and it's one that we should follow, but it's not easy. Say if we hear it, we read this story in the Bhagavatam, or if we hear it, from now on, I've done this 10,000 times, from now on I'm going to always chant, from now on whenever there's difficulty I'm going to always take shelter upward and not let my mind trick me again. How many times have I done that? So it sounds, it's simple on one level, but it's not so simple to do. And because of that point, we are giving you an extra bonus. Instead of just four truths, you're going to get a free, at no extra cost, a fifth truth. But it's very mysterious. It's T-O-B and N-O-M. Because I showed this last week and I wasn't going to tell you what they mean. Did anyone figure out this great code?
No.
Huh? Okay. 2 rupees and I'll tell you. Okay. T-O-B means try our best. Unless we understand the ideal, we don't know what to strive for. So even though these points are simple on one level, but difficult to apply because we have so many other desires and we have so many other habits. But yet we should try our best. That is called sincerity. We should try our best to take shelter of the Absolute Truth, and perhaps we will fail 1,000 times. And perhaps we will fail 10,000 times. Perhaps we will continuously fail, but we should sincerely and humbly try our best, because N-O-M means the need of mercy. Unless we try our best, then mercy doesn't happen. It is not that trying our best forces mercy to occur, forces it to descend upon us, forces grace. But unless we try our best, because mercy is ultimately causeless, otherwise it's not mercy, it's just business. The example that I tend to use is like, say if there's a young boy and there's a big heavy set of weights, like from the gym, and he decides he's going to pick it up. Now, he doesn't have any capacity. He's just a kid, 4 years old. He doesn't have any capacity to lift these 30 kilo on each side weights. But when he makes the attempt, then his powerful father gets right behind him and says, you try again, one more time, you try it. And then the father does the actual lifting. Now, who's lifting it? The boy or the father? Well, you could say, of course the father's lifting it. But if it wasn't for the boy's desire, the father wouldn't be inclined to do it, to lift it. So that's the try our best. There's so many wonderful stories in the Bhagavatam about this, but This is the system. And this is often the problem. In every relationship, not in every relationship, but there's a tendency in relationships because in every relationship there's two participants. So one participant is he's expert at seeing the fault and what the other one is not doing. This is what happens all the time. And this is usually what causes the most problems in marriages, that the husband or the wife is saying, well, you're not doing this, and you should be doing this, and you should be doing that. And then the other one says, well, you should be doing this, and you should be doing that, and you should be doing that. Yeah, but you should be doing that, you should be doing that. Everyone is very expert at seeing what the problem is and what the other person isn't doing. And I should have put truth six is MYOB, which means mind your own business. Is that you should mind your own business and take, because if you're not doing your business, who else is doing your business? No one will do your business for you. And if you're minding the other person's business. So we should figure out what our duty is, what the proper way for us to act in the relationship, and then let the other person figure out what the other person's proper way of acting is or should be. So it's the same thing in our relationship with the Supreme Absolute Truth. So I've seen this so many times. Everyone asks for mercy or blessings. Please give me blessings, please give me blessings, please give me blessings. But whose job is the mercy or the blessings? Is that, that's the job of the Supreme Absolute Truth or the Holy Person. So instead of you telling that person, give me blessings, as if he's a blessing ATM or something like that. No, that's his prerogative. That's his. Of course, we need mercy, but on the other side, we should mind our own business and act in such a way, as Srila Prabhupada, my teacher, used to say, quoting his spiritual master: "Don't try and see Krishna, but act in such a way that Krishna sees you." That's the key. Because in that there's so much satisfaction. To actually try to please another brings so much satisfaction. And selfishness on the other hand, brings so much alienation. Selfishness is so unnatural. There was one old Bengali gentleman in Krishna and the temple in Vrindavan, the ISKCON temple in Vrindavan, who used to say, "I am the worst kind of fish. I'm a selfish." And it's true. I mean, not that he was, but it's true that selfishness just doesn't bring us satisfaction. It's love that brings satisfaction. It's serving that brings satisfaction. It's savor that brings satisfaction. Not even on the highest spiritual level, which is brings the true satisfaction of the soul, but in ordinary life, we serve with a heart to please the other and not be attached to getting something as a result of the service, and that brings satisfaction. Even on an ordinary level, what to speak of on this highest transcendental spiritual level, where one is fully involved in lovingly serving the Absolute Truth. So Narada Muni was a past master of that, and perhaps I am not. So
So I need mercy, but what can I do? And that is try our best. I didn't say try my best because TOB sounds better than TMB. TMB doesn't work. We try our best. We try our best. And regardless of our failures, don't worry, because our failures make us more humble. We try. When you set the ideal, then it's so clear when you fall to a lesser level than the ideal. And then what happens? Oh, I've done it again. I've fallen into the same trap. I need help. Then you become humble. And it's the humility that attracts the benevolent blessings from above. But unless we have our eye focused on the ideal and are trying our best, humility will never blossom in our hearts. So I wanted to, Premananda, could you take that little old stick and see if you can go to my computer, and somewhere there's a that, remember that little video I showed at the temple of and so if I think it's under videos maybe, or I think maybe under in the video under GGS, I think. In that regard, in this regard, what does that say over there? Kaspersky. Total security. Do you feel secure now? Totally secure? Now you feel less secure. Oh, that's curious. What a wonderful picture of curious Govardhan. Raise your hand if you've not been to Vrindavan yet. Well, at the end, I hope to give you we're going to have a little video visit to Vrindavan. But what a wonderful photo of Kiriras, a hill. So beautiful. So, in regard to mercy and the need for mercy and the need to try our best, I wanted to tell you a true story of someone who was very, very dear to me, who passed away just a year ago, a little more than a year ago, and his name was Gunagrahi Swami. Now, probably none of you in the room in this Lakshmi Moni. Is Lakshmi Moni here? Yeah. Didn't know Gunagrahi Maharaj. He was, and I told this at the temple one day. Who raise your hand if you were at the temple when I told it? Okay, that's a whole bunch of people. So I'm going to have to tell it in French or something like that. Otherwise, it might get boring. But we went to the same university, and that was over 50 years ago. And he was the drummer in the local band, the band in those, it was the 60s, and he couldn't come in. How many minutes late did you come?
Just here.
Huh?
Vinaya.
Oh, okay, because I was going to tell you to set your clock far too that many minutes ahead for next time. You okay today?
Yeah.
Happy? Did any great disasters occur today? No wonder you're happy. So, the band's name was the Uncalled For. You have to find out the first name they, or the second name they, was called the Uncalled For, and then they changed it to the Conquerors, as they were trying to, that will fit in very well in Australia, when they were really trying to make it big. So, he was the drummer in the band, Did you find it?
I think I may have it because I didn't have the password for the computer.
Oh, okay. But you may have it. Yeah, why don't you just let me know? Now we're all, because I gave it to you to show it that day. So when I began chanting Hare Krishna, while still in the university, then a few months later he began chanting Hare Krishna. He began chanting Hare Krishna. And I remember one day when we were in New York, the devotees were all... Wait a second, don't show it, but you have it. Everything is already there. So I really wanted him to become a devotee. But you can't... Sometimes the devotees say, I've made someone a devotee or something like that, but you don't make someone into a devotee. It's between Krishna and that person. And so Gunagrahi, his name was George at that time, he after some time he began chanting Hare Krishna and he joined the temple in Buffalo, and I had left by then, I had gone somewhere else. And something I wanted to tell you about the movement that my teacher Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, began. When he was 70 years old, he left India because his spiritual teacher, his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, had requested him to spread Krishna consciousness, the chanting of Hare Krishna, in English. So at 70 years old, and he was a sannyasi at that time, and he had no wealth at all. He somehow got on a boat that landed in Boston first and then in New York. He took such a risk. Once he was walking in Calcutta, and in Calcutta there is a giant monument called the Victoria Monument that was built during the British times. And Prabhupada was walking with his disciples, and this was in the 70s, and he was remembering that when it was being built, they were using scaffolding, bamboo scaffolding, to build it. And he was remembering that as a young Calcutta boy, he had climbed to the top of it on the scaffolding. And so one of his disciples said to him, you must have been so brave. And Prabhupada very gravely replied, I still am brave. Otherwise, how could I have come alone at 70 years old with no sponsor? He didn't go into them. He said, how could I have come all alone? Because it takes a certain spirit of bravery, a certain hardy spirit to trust Krishna is going to take care of you, like Narada Muni had to learn. So Prabhupada was very much like that. He had that spirit. And he liked very much when his disciples, his students, had captured that spirit too. Because the reason why Prabhupada wanted to spread Krishna consciousness and get and have people chant Hare Krishna and distribute Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita was because he saw the way that the world was going. Now, we also see the way that the world is going. And if you want to have nightmares, just listen to the news before you go to sleep. I mean, there's conflict in every place. There's no place where there's not any conflict, practically speaking. And people don't have security nowadays. The families break apart. The financial insecurity, so much insecurity. The land prices go up and they go down. Threats of nuclear catastrophes. it's just continuous. So Prabhupada saw that the way things were going, and it's based on ignorance. And the cure for ignorance is knowledge. And chanting chanting Hare Krishna has the capacity to give someone a taste from a higher level, a different platform, and give meaning to one's life. Instead of just chasing, that which, all the zeros, things of zero value that everyone is chasing. So Prabhupada had two moods in one sense. In one sense, he had two moods. One was he was so strong, and he would speak so bluntly about the nature of the material world. I don't know if those of you who from a Christian upbringing, he was like, or a biblical upbringing, he was like an Old Testament prophet, which means like he would just stand there and speak the truth of the way things are going, that this is wrong and this is wrong and this is foolish and this is terrible. And on the other side, his other part of him was so sweet, and he carried with him this bubble, I would call it, of Vrindavan, the sweetness of Vrindavan, the sweetness of that other realm, the spiritual realm. He carried that with him because he had it. So, and he had the spirit, he had the urgency, he felt the urgency to help this very pained world that was spiraling downward very quickly, based on ignorance, without any knowledge. So he wanted to distribute knowledge. So when any devotees, any of his disciples, picked up that spirit, that compassionate spirit, he very much appreciated them. Oops, excuse me. Sitting down a little too much today and caught a little bit of a cramp in my leg, so I might as well just dance the rest of the story. Hare Krishna. Can't dance without drinking at least a little water. I'm going to get myself into trouble.
What should you put in there?
So, Gunagrahi had this spirit. And he had it right, the whole movement, the Hare Krishna movement, had it in the beginning days. But Gunagrahi Maharaj, he really had it. And he started, when he was just young, he started a temple in San Diego that is still going now. Then he did this and he did that. His whole life was filled with the spirit of starting something, going somewhere, and just starting, getting people in some place or another to chant. And he was very much a general type. You know, there's different kinds of people in this world, and he was a general. The general kind, you know, they give orders that has to be specific like this, it has to be specific like that. They organize everything, and they're very, very particular like that. So he was like that. At some point, I want to explain that he wasn't perfect. You know, when someone's passed away, you never want to mention that part, because everyone in this world has imperfections. So usually when someone passes away, you speak about all the good qualities that the person has, and he did this, and he was like this, and he was so good in this way, and he was so kind. And Gunagrahi Maharaj was really like that too. He loved to get everyone, wherever he went, he got people surrounding him, chanting. Somehow or another, he always got something going wherever he went. And in his last days, when he was in Vrindavan, he when he was so ill, he was waning, getting thinner and thinner and thinner, because he ended up with cancer. And he was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And he was a general. He was very determined. And he was taking he took one different cure. He wouldn't give up. I'm going to show these doctors. He told me one time that they don't know. The medical doctors said that it's not curable, but I'll show them that it is curable. But it wasn't working as far as I could see. So we were in touch continuously, almost every day. As soon as I found out that he had cancer, we were in touch almost every day through WhatsApp, exchanging messages. And then when I'd be in Vrindavan, I'd spend every day, I would spend some time with him. And our relationship was so open. And one of the great qualities he had, he was so open. He would tell me anything and everything, whatever was going on, whatever. And just we had such an open. After all, we had known each other for 50 years, and then and I saw that Krishna was making different arrangements for him, but I saw also that he was going down and down and down and down. But he wasn't ready to accept it yet. That instead of preparing to live, that it was starting to be the time to prepare to die. One other thing that I noticed is that when you're in the last days of one's life, you may think, now you may think, that now it's easy to think when it's time for me to die, then I'm going to do all the spiritual things and focus my mind as I've neglected for the rest of earlier. Then I'll really focus my mind because it's coming close to the end. But one of the things I saw is that that's one of the most difficult things to do, even for a person who's focused their life on trying to please, exalt, and spread Krishna consciousness, and trying to please an exalted teacher, like Prabhupada. Because I saw that you have to take this medicine, and then you have to take that medicine, and then someone has to come in and clean here, and someone has to help you brush your teeth, and then someone has to carry you to the bathroom. Our nurses know all about how difficult. It's just really difficult. And then and even though you may want to focus your mind, it just doesn't work in that way. The mind is afraid. There's pain in the body. It's uncomfortable. It's just not easy. So I saw him go down and down and down. I had to leave back to Perth, and then one day, just towards the end of August of, I guess last year, the 20th of 2018, when it was so hot in Vrindavan in the summer, and there was just a few devotees taking care of him, but there were other devotees in who appreciated him. Some of his god brothers, they sent him so much help. They sent extra people to take care of him, help take care of him, because it's, you could say almost in one sense, it's harder to be a carer than the person who's going through the difficulties. It's so difficult to be a carer because it demands so much unselfishness. You have to take your own needs and place them over here because this person really needs you. And you can't say, well, I'm not in the mood right now. I don't feel like it. That's one of the most difficult of all professions, is the caring profession.
like that, those who care for the, and so often the people are being cared for are bad tempered because of their pain and everything like that and the difficulties they're in and their minds are disturbed, and still the people who can do that, they're really special souls. So he kept going down and down and down, and I was in Perth, and one day I got a message, and he just said, please come. Because he was all alone, he said, meaning that if none of his friends were around him, and you really want to be with people that you trust and love at these most difficult times. So I ended up going a lot earlier than I took in Davin, which then I was expecting to go. And then by the time I got there, he was in the palliative care ward of the hospital, Bhaktivedanta Hospital in Vrindavan. And it was so interesting to me. If you ever go into that little hospital, which is very close to Krishna Balaram Mandir, you see there's a photo of one disciple of His Holiness Giriraj Maharaj, whose name was Archivigraha, and she had passed away in Vrindavan years and years before, and she had left. She was a famous artist in South Africa, and she had left money, and I think His Holiness Giriraj Maharaj also contributed a lot, and they built a hospital, a hospice, so that people could be taken care of when they're leaving this world in this very holy place. So this big photograph of Archivigraha, that was the lady's name, who was inspired, who left in Vrindavan and understood the need for this, it's so piercing. You really feel, I've almost never seen a photo like that. You feel like you're in her presence when you see that photograph. And it's so piercing. And you just feel like, thank you for what for your consideration. See, that's goodness of the heart. You don't want people to suffer like you've suffered. So, while I was with him, there were other devotees there. His Holiness Uttapa Samaraj came, and so many devotees came by the end. And I saw that the society, the compassionate society that was the result of Prabhupada's work, Prabhupada's sacrifice, at the age of 70, coming alone, I saw the effect that it had. Because he was in this hospital, which was made by Prabhupada's followers. He was surrounded near the end, he was surrounded by so many devotees were chanting, helping him fix his mind on Krishna at this most difficult time. And I saw also something even more than that, though. Excuse me. I saw that, I actually saw a miracle take place at that time. It's because he was in so much pain. One of his greatest fears, he had two great fears, he told me. One of his greatest fears was that he would be all alone at this time. And a second of his greatest fears was that the pain would be so great that they would have to medicate him. And the nature of these kind of medications is that they really cover your consciousness. And they can make your mind do the most strange things. So he feared that. He feared that at the end of his life, he wouldn't be able to focus his consciousness on Krishna. And he who had given his life to spreading Krishna consciousness, faults as he may have had,
feared that at the last moment he himself wasn't going to be able to chant or think of Krishna. So how is Krishna going to deal with him? So in the very last moments, last hours, one of the devotees who had, one very prominent devotee in his time, His Holiness Radhanath Swami, and then His Holiness Govinda Maharaj came, and Ratatva Maharaj was already there. And Govinda Maharaj, he began chanting for 6 hours when it was near the end. For 6 hours he was just chanting, and there were tens and tens and tens of devotees in the room, just chanting and chanting and chanting. And by this time, because of his pain, he was intravenously feeding medication to cover the pain, because it's such a difficult thing. If you don't take the medication, you can't tolerate the pain, and you're just thinking about pain all the time. If you do take the medication, then the danger is that your consciousness will be covered. So what do you do? So they tried to just try to keep the doctors expert, and they try to keep the balance on this, not too much, not too little. But his pain in the last hours became so great. And at one point I was holding his arm, and he began squeezing my arm. So difficult to tolerate seeing someone such an open-hearted relationship with it, so much pain. And the doctor had to increase the medication still more. So he increased it more. And then Gunagraha Maharaj, his eyes went back and his mouth opened. And if you've ever been around people who are near the time to leave, that's what they look like. You know, very often they're not there. And the doctor said, he's gone into a coma. He said, it's over. I kept thinking, how is Krishna going to deal with him? He's given everything. He's really tried his best. Is Krishna going to give him mercy or not? Is the Supreme Absolute Truth, who's a person, going to reciprocate with this person, faulty as he may have been, who's really, really sincerely tried his best? So he went into a coma. And then Govinda Maharaj came over to him during the kirtan. We thought that he was finished because he had chanted 6 hours. I don't know if you can imagine what it's like leading a kirtan powerfully for 6 hours. You're exhausted. It was already 3 o'clock in the morning. We had been chanting all night long. So finally he got up very close to him. And he became, and we were watching, there was I don't know what the machines are called, but you know, they have your life symptoms hooked up to either your toe or your foot or something like that, and we're all watching the screen. You know, and sometimes we're not watching him even, we're watching the screen go up, his life symptoms are up, and then they crash down, and then we think it's almost over, and then they go up again, and they go down. You've seen that kind of a thing. And you know, we're chanting and chanting, and he's like this. And then suddenly he begins chanting along with Govinda Maharaj chanting Hare Krishna. You can see him moving his mouth, which was more or less impossible, because he's in a coma. And the doctor, even, who's gone through palliative care doctors, that's what they do. He was amazed. He'd never seen anything like that. He was chanting, even though he was in a coma, practically speaking. And the chanting and chanting went on. And then he left at a very auspicious time in this holy place of Vrindavan, surrounded by hundreds of devotees carrying the mercy of Prabhupada. And rather than being a terrible time, it was the sweetest time. And everyone in the room experienced the atmosphere. Everyone in the room experienced the atmosphere. It was just like the spiritual realm. And the artist part of it, in one sense, was that because this is the crazy digital age, there were all these devotees like live streaming it on Facebook, this person passing away, and hundreds and thousands of people around the world saw him leaving and chanting with his eyes back. It was astounding. Everyone was a witness. So many hundreds of thousands of people were a witness to this amazing thing that mercy came. He tried his best and mercy came. He sincerely tried his best and mercy came. Krishna doesn't forget. He's a person, supreme person, and doesn't forget. I want to show you this. I put together a little video. This is poor quality. He used to get the kirtans going in his place. He was playing the conga drums. And he always would back up. He wasn't the lead singer. It's such a taste for the holy names, chanting and spreading it. Pause it for a second. And sometimes he'd be in such pain. He'd be lying in bed, just in complete pain. And then the kirtan would start. On every night, I can't remember, maybe from 6 o'clock to 7:30 or something like that, it would start. And suddenly, he'd be filled with life. And he would get put on his proper clothes and wheel himself out there on the walker over there, and he would tell me that when I'm chanting like that, there's no difficulty. Such a taste. And every time he would do that, as much as one can do that, he had such a taste for the holy names. He inspired so many people. Sometimes there were 100 people there, sometimes a few people, sometimes 10. It always went on. This is in the palliative care room already. Thank you.
is nearing the end. Let's go into the mouth. Please try your best. Try your best. Okay, that's the end of our three-part seminar. Now, I really wanted to leave a lot of time for questions, but instead, I wanted to, I don't know if it's the right time to do it, but I wanted to bring you to Vrindavan with one video. That our very own Gopal edited, and just play that one, because I wanted to end with something. But I actually wanted to show something about Kalbari, but the message of the Kalbari one. It's, raise your hand if you've been to Kalbari.
Kalbari.
Yes, that's what I meant to say. Yes.
Door.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You like it?
Yeah. I used to go in every holiday.
Yes.
My family used to go up there for 2 weeks.
It's such a wonderful place, actually. I really like. How do you pronounce it?
Kalbari.
Kalbari. Okay.
I'm going
into it. Oh, you're going into it too. I should show you this one, but there's not enough time. So with this, but the message of that is, it's so Kalbari is so nice, but I'm missing some of the sweetness of Vrindavan.
That's 100%
connected to GPS and USB
audio.
Thank you, my dear.
Audio.
Okay, we'll go right to Vrindavan. Maybe you can catch some of the sweetness of Vrindavan.
Wow.
That's the Yamuna River.
Life on the Yamuna's other side. Traffic speeds and honks. We cross the trembling Yamuna. Yamuna Bridge. Near the soothing river below, a bullock cart and camel cart meet and part on the thin dirt village road between green and fertile furrowed fields as cranes walk easy through the Jamuna's shallow winter waters. Down the Rai Vrindavan Road, an old bent tree, a lush green field of wheat, is beautified by Krishna, the artist's touch of yellow mustard blossoms. Traffic whizzes. We weave through cars, bikes, carts, autos, trucks, and buses to enter an olden realm, Balaram's side of the Yamuna. In a cow-dung universe, a nearby village in the distance, a red saried lady by hand creates village fuel, cow patties. A thin young daughter in jeans crouches and helps as a tied bull stands, creating dung. Rest easy. Daughter follows mother, both walking that path home to their village as in countless years past. A tied up cow.
She doesn't want me to go near her calf. It's an anxiety.
Don't go near. Protective mother. Danger.
Someone in the background is warning me. Oh, Maharaj! Oh.
I see a fine photo nearby. A rooftop capture, multicolored cloth with girl and friends in brick. But the village kids crowd in, one by one, pushing, laughing, eager to be photographed. I see a one-toothed camel used for pulling roads. I'm coming. And before a pastel blue village door, we meet 12-year-old Kajal, who each day ferries across the Yamuna River to school in Vrindavan.
How old?
Okay. Hare Krishna. Radhe, Radhe, Radhe. Jai Sri Radhe. Hare Krishna.
Si.
The wizened village mother tells why buffaloes and buffalo milk in this village fare better than cows and cow milk.
Make you more strong.
Yes, more strong. Buffalo.
Like buffalo.
The
cow is sattva-gun.
Cow milk is good for kids.
Yes.
Beneath the shade of a leaf tree, a cow stands tied with tree leaves just beyond her reach. How many times has she tried and failed? Yet she remains peaceful, a cow. Surrounded by green wheat on a thin dirt road, a village lady crouches, fashioning patties with her hand. Only in Braja will a gopi scarecrow stand guard over fields of budding cauliflowers. Vajra, millet, tall, green, and healthy, crowned with countless corn-like rusks. A cow sits, chewing cud. The honking sound? What? Selling to children. Not balloons of green and yellow, but tasty condiment powders for a rupee from a moving bicycle shop, distributed to village kids by kindly Trigor and his jolly son, Gopak. Life is a simpler but harder life, yet it strengthens both body and mind. More like Krishna's Braja Cowherd days that have slowly been pillaged by time. Phones and apps, but peaceful, satisfied. Despite tech progress, undeterred, with all the gains and advancement made, everyone's mostly disturbed. Kali Yuga's push against simplicity has long ago begun, and Kali's allurements have covered life's best values, replacing them quickly with flickering but poisonous fun. Now, villagers flee their villages. A peaceful, simple life is no longer a good life's measure. They flock to cities filled with passion, craving and searching for fleeting pleasures. Shastra's advice and Kali's great cure is chant always Krishna's name, making your heart simple and pure. To Harinam, ferocious Kali, you'll tame. Seek to be as tolerant as a tree. Actively please divinity. Give honor not expected from others. View all souls dearly, despite their differing bodily covers. Fulfill life's purpose, the essence of sweet. Sheltered in Braj's coward village at last, serving Shyamasundar's pinkish lotus feet.
Gopaldas.